Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Sports Grid Fantasy Football Podcast. My name is Davis Maddock. I'm joined on this lovely Friday by Rich Rebar. Hopefully, we are able to be running back our phenomenal series that everyone loved when we were in the regular season of just smashing the bookies on Fridays. Ooh. Even against stale lines, Rich, we were crushing on Fridays. You love to see it.
I am dying to bet on some sports. You know, I told you, like, I'm actually in Ohio. We do not have the online sports books available to us at FanDuel and DraftKings, the betting side. I'm at least allowed to play DFS on those sites. But my local bookie actually is not dealing baseball lines, and I have to check in with him today on these basketball lines. So I haven't been able to bet on anything in a long time. So I'm dying for football to come back just so I could get a live wager in.
I mean, we are coming out of the desert, and I gotta say, I don't know how many days of baseball plus basketball trying to play DraftKings and FanDuel. Like the Thursday, July 30th was, I was just sitting there on my computer, just like, man, I don't know how many days of this that I have in me, especially because I'm trying to do this in a Damian Williams-less world. I just took Damian Williams at 7.10 in the Pros versus Joes league that I did, and you had the reverse luck of me because you just bang knocked Clyde Edwards-Helaire out of the park at the 307 in your Pros versus Joes.
Yeah, I mean, Clyde Edwards-Helaire is not someone I've really been setting out to draft in these snake drafts just because, you know, I am a little more risk averse at the top of snake drafts, and he's been going kind of, you know, like that 2-3 turn and around some players that have a little more stability. Now, I've always thought the upside was there, but I mean, in a tournament setting where he fell below ADP, I was like, oh, I'm hitting him. Like, kind of that Mike Beers factor of, like, if guys fall below their ADP in best ball, I'm going to always draft them. And then it's a tournament style in Pros versus Joes where I'm not even trying to win my 1-12-team sector. I'm just shooting for the moon. I also took him in the SFB for the same reasons. He fell below ADP, and then it's just a setting where I just am shooting – for the ceiling. So I mean, it wasn't like I set out to get him. It was just one of those, he kind of just fell there and I took him because he was there. Now, where he's going to go now is probably, I think we're starting to see, like, anywhere from what, 105 to 108 is kind of where he's kind of settling at this point. And then maybe you have someone reach really highly for him, but I think that's where he's going to settle. I ended up moving, I don't know where you moved him. I made him like the top of the next tier running back, so I still had Adams and Michael Thomas ahead of him as the wide receivers ahead of him. And then he kind of leads off that next wave of running backs for me. So I don't know where you ended up selling.
So I had him higher than that. Like, I had him higher than consensus anyways, because I was talking to Mike Clay about this. I think he came on the show 3 weeks ago, and we both sort of agreed that, you know, normal season, you know, assuming no COVID anything, like, kind of the way that the Chiefs would have played it would have been, Damian Williams was the 1A for the first month probably, where he's probably getting 10 to 12 carries. Because remember, the Chiefs are basically the most pass-heavy team in football history, right? They're throwing on about 65% of downs in normal scenarios. So we're thinking probably 10 to 12 carries for Damian, probably 5 to 8 for Clyde Edwards-Helaire, and then, you know, probably 8-ish targets a game split in between those two guys. But then as the season progressed, basically assuming that Clyde Edwards-Helaire is what the Chiefs thought, because, you know, teams do draft these running backs, they draft these wide receivers, they get them into practice, and they're like, oh, this guy can't play, right? Like the Bishop Sankey, where the team drafts him, they have this role set up for him, and he just literally is not good enough to do it. So assuming that Clyde Edwards-Helaire is good enough to do it, he is as impressive as Andy Reid thought, I pretty much envisioned him taking things over by like week 8 or so. And that's a super valuable player, right? Obviously, we know any lead running back in the Chiefs offense is just going to get, I mean, more than the yards and everything, you just know they are set up to get the easiest touchdowns of all time, because that offense is always in the red zone. And, you know, we've seen it with Kareem Hunt, we've seen it with Damian, the way they use their running backs is just very easy for them to score. All that being said, I have him, I think you can take him as early as number 3 now. I do. I have him projected for the RB7, but one, I don't trust my own math on Derrick Henry, because I think it's a super fragile projection where I could see that projection being off by 100 points either way, basically. But if you were telling me, look, after Barkley, after McCaffrey, I want the dude who's playing with Patrick Mahomes at 3, I have no argument against it.
Yeah, no, me neither, if that's your logic. I mean, definitely the upside is there. It's kind of, like I said, just being a little more risk averse and knowing that maybe, you know, because we've been here before with a lot of these guys, especially guys taken, you know, in that area of the draft. I know that people say, well, he's a first round running back, but I mean, he was taking pick 32 and all those other running backs were taken within like a 10 pick radius of him.
Right.
And then, you know, recently, you know, the past, you know, what, like the last, since 2009, there have been, what, 38 running backs that were selected, you know, round two or higher, but at pick 15 overall later, just four of those guys had 250 touches in year one. My thought coming in before this was that he was going to be used a lot, like rookie year Christian McCaffrey, who had like 198 touches, was used more in the pass game, not really used in the goal line. Because remember, Clyde Edwards-Helaire is a 207-pound dude, and Damien is a 225-pound guy. I always thought that that was going to be, like, the one thing.
Damien is good. Like, that's the most frustrating thing about all of this is that Damien, when he's gotten playing time at every level, he's smashed. And, like, people do forget that, obviously.
But I always thought that that was the one thing that, no matter what, even if Clyde Edwards-Helaire started earning more touches, the one looming fact that was, like, there was an edge for Damien Williams being a 225-pound running back that he would still be used, like, near the paint. And now Clyde Edwards-Helaire, if you look at the remaining Chiefs backs on the roster,
he's the biggest guy.
They're all, outside of Darrell Williams, they're all the same archetype. Darwin Thompson's 200 pounds. DeAndre Washington's 210 pounds. People are like, well, if they signed Devontae Freeman, that's the same archetype too. Like, it's so, like, he only has one guy to kind of, like, get in the way in goal line carries now too. So it really has opened up for him to really kind of smash and, you know, kind of hit the ground running. I'll definitely still take the under on the 325 rookie touches that Kareem Hunt had, because the next highest back that season that had in terms of carries was Charkandrick West, nearly, you know, like 18 carries that year. I think there will be another Chiefs back that gets more than 18 carries.
Well, I think they will play. So first of all, I mean, we got the shower narrative with DeAndre Washington, right?
Oh boy. Yeah.
But DeAndre Washington actually, in the times where he's gotten, like, legitimate playing time in the NFL, has been totally acceptable. Like, he hasn't been Saquon Barkley, but he's been, you know, basically right above average or a little bit above average in terms of, like, fantasy points.
At the end of last year, for sure, he helped
me
out in a couple leagues and got.
I mean, he beat out Jalen Richard, and, you know, the Raiders gave Jalen Richard, what was it, 4 years, $16 million or something like that. And Washington played better than him, but I assume he just wanted to go play for the Chiefs, so he wasn't interested in any kind of contract negotiation with them. My Clyde Edwards-Helaire projection, let me see if I can find it here real quick. I just tweeted it out the other day. I went pretty aggressive on the carries, but less aggressive than the market on target share, because I actually do think that, well, I'm much higher than the market on Mecole Hardman, and I'm not willing to take away from Hardman to give this offense more running back carries, basically. So 224 carries, 987 rushing yards, 8.9 rushing touchdowns, 88 targets, 539 receiving yards, 2.8 receiving touchdowns. If I was betting, I would take the under on the carries probably, but maybe that touchdown line of 11 actually sounds about right to me.
Yeah, I think I've got him right now at 9.9 total touchdowns, but I tend to, you know, be a little more
conservative.
I'm like Mike Clay, like, when I do the projection wise.
Because yeah, I try and be conservative.
Because I'm not someone that uses projections really strictly anyways, in a strict sense of, like, rankings and in terms of drafting anyways. I'm really just looking for a baseline, and then I'm also looking to see, like, if I give guys, you know, if I alter their actual opportunity shares, what it looks like is from a ceiling and floor perspective. That's how I use them. I mean, I'm using my tiers more than anything, because I'm tiering dudes up, you know, based on their archetype and how they get opportunities on the football field anyways. And to me, he's right in that same strike zone of, you know, a Miles Sanders, you know, in probably a little bit hyper over, like, an Austin Eckler and Alvin Kamara, that group of guys that's not one of those 300 carry type running backs, and probably not a 300 touch running back, but is the gets the types of touches that we want, because they're getting a high volume of their team carries and also a high target share, which we love for fantasy, even in standard leagues. People don't realize how valuable targets are in standard leagues over, you know, getting, you know, rushing attempts, you know? So, I mean, even in standard leagues, they'll still target for running back is exponentially worth more than a carry. And a lot of people disregard that. And he's got that now. I mean, he probably has an 80 target floor if he remains healthy, you know, throughout the season.
Where do you stand on Miles Sanders, by the way? How early is too early for him? I personally have taken him as early as 7th, I think. I think if I was on the clock in one of these high stakes leagues, you know, the main event or whatever, I would actually take him over Michael Thomas. Like I would not hesitate on that.
Yeah, I set out to take him. I had the 107 in my pros versus Joe Jefferson, the most recent draft I did, which is that big tournament setting. And I actually planned on taking him at 107 coming in. My plan was to take Miles Sanders at 107.
Did your league lay down and give you
I got Dalvin Cook.
Yeah, I was going to say.
Yeah, so I mean, I just took Cook for the, you know, there. But I am with you on that. I've been really going back and forth on Sanders versus Mixon, and I think that Sanders – is going to end up surpassing him just because I believe his target share is a lot more projectable. I mean, even when Mixon was smashing at the end of the year, in the final 8 weeks of the season, only Christian McCaffrey had more touches and more yards for scrimmage than Joe Mixon. But over that span, Giovanni Bernard still ran more pass routes than Joe Mixon. So he was still contingent on some of the game script, too, to get those targets. And, I mean, listen, Mixon was a guy who smashed as a receiver at Oklahoma. He just hasn't gotten that opportunity yet in the league. But we can't really bank on the rational coaching based on the way he's been used.
And as long as Gio is on the roster, I agree with you. Yeah, I mean.
So it's just really tough. He hasn't finished higher than 25th among running backs and receiving points per game in any of his first 3 years. And like I said, Gio still ran more pass routes than him over that back end of season when he was getting all those touches. And we talk with Derrick Henry and Nick Chubb and Josh Jacobs, these other running backs that are high. I mean, there is a lot of fragility in terms of weekly floor when these guys don't score touchdowns.
Yeah, two targets a game for these fellas.
We talked about it in a text thread, and Evan kind of bagged on me for trying to penalize Derrick Henry for scoring touchdowns. But Derrick Henry's had 34 career games where he hasn't scored a touchdown, and he hasn't been an RB2 or higher in any of them for fantasy that week.
It's the most insane stat you've ever told me. I think I've been reading the worksheet. I've been reading your stuff for like, it feels like a decade now. And I think that is one of the most unreal things I've ever heard.
I mean, he scores a lot of touchdowns. That's why like, it doesn't really come up to be a problem, but like his weekly floor is just really contingent on him scoring a touchdown. And there are some guys in the league like that. And there's some guys that go highly. I think Nick Chubb will have some oscillation back in his favor for scoring more rushing touchdowns. But I always get asked too, like, who do you favor out of the Miami running backs? And like Jordan Howard's the same way. I think Jordan Howard's a safer bet than Matt Breida, but like Jordan Howard, every week you're gonna have weeks where you don't play him because he either has a crummy matchup or, and you know, he doesn't catch passes, but like he's only good if he scores a touchdown.
Literally only. Yeah.
You're going to miss out on some weeks like that. Adam Harstad was just on with Sigmund Bloom and was talking about these fringe players that have these spike weeks, but you miss out on almost all their points scored a season because they're hard to play. And for those reasons, like a guy like Jordan Howard's going to be like that this year, where it's like Matt Breida, like you may not always play him, but like, you know, the upside's there. And like, you know that you could probably play him in your flex spot because they're going to throw and be throwing. And
yeah. You would start him in week 7 when you have dudes on bye, and like, regardless of who they play, like I have no idea who Miami plays in week 7,
right?
But you would just play him just because you're like, yeah, he'll probably get like 8 carries, 4 targets, and maybe he binks a touchdown, right? And like,
I definitely think from the traditional value stance, we always get this every summer as well, and people are like, well, this guy's a value at ADP. And I definitely think Jordan Howard's a guy who would beat his ADP in overall points. But like, what are we really saying? And we also see this other, all this stuff when we talk about fantasy football summer, is like, this guy, he was the RB9 last year. This guy was the tight end 8. Like, what the hell are we even saying? Like, that's, you're telling me something more about the RB9 and the tight end 8 than you are telling me anything about an individual player. In that sense, like if you're not one of the top players in the position, it still is contingent on, you know, pockets of production. All these guys are going to have weeks where they're in like a tight median of points, and then they're going to have real outliers up and real outliers down. And like, they're just not a lot of high scoring weekly consistent players per NFL season outside of a handful of guys. And we're living in that pockets of volatility with everybody else. So, I mean, when you tell me like a guy was the RB12 or the RB13, like what are we really even saying?
Like,
when
it's like the David Johnson 2018 year when the Cardinals were just miserable and you hated starting David Johnson every year, but he was like technically an RB1, but like had a win rate of like 0%.
Right. Like, I mean, we're not really saying a lot of stuff. Like, people always drop the Jason Witten's been a tight end one every year of his career. Like, yeah, you're not saying anything about Jason Witten, man. You're telling me something about the tight end one position in fantasy football. Like, it's, you're not, I mean, it does every year, though. Like, once we get in season, definitely this stuff takes a shelf. But, you know, we do 9 months of looking at just like this full season products backwards and forward. And it gets kind of, you know, aggravating that this type of stuff is like really considered, like, you know, we talked about, I think last time I did a show with you, we were talking about David Montgomery and as a guy that would be.
I mean, he's the guy. He's like, the poster boy for, like, he is going to
be his ADP. Like,
100%. Yeah. And I will take David Montgomery sometimes, but I'm not taking him because I think he's going to win me my league. I'm taking him because, one, you need to score some points at running back, but also he does actually have mega upside if Tari Cohen gets hurt, because then you're talking about like a 220 carry, 100 target type guy, because that offense will just throw to their running backs a ton. Basically, that's like something we know for sure about the Nagy offense. They will just do that. And it's not going to be Ryan.
Surprisingly had decent in air yardage as well, the way they used him.
He looks kind of spry when he catches passes. Yeah.
Yeah, so, I mean, it's interesting. I mean, he was 40th at the position in targets and 51st in receiving points per game. But he was 23rd in routes run. It's just that Tariq Cohen was 8th in routes run. So, yeah, if Cohen was the missed time, I mean, yeah, I definitely see the volume argument for David Montgomery. It's just like, yeah, circling back to what I was like kind of leading in is, you know, we always talk about people who are like determine value as beating ADP, but there's just so much more that goes into the minutia of fantasy football. And like I said, it really is just about being in on the right pockets of production for these players and not having their spike weeks on your bench, you know, having them in your lineups. And David Montgomery's a guy you're probably at least going to start more weeks than not if you do draft him, at least.
All right, so let's get into the COVID wrinkles, because obviously we're just not going to have a normal season, right? Or maybe we will. Maybe the NFL gets into a bubble. Maybe they figure it out. I am not optimistic about that. You know, my general sense is that we are going to have guys test positive in season. Just as you and I are recording, we got news that another team now has had to cancel games. The Brewers-Cardinals game that was supposed to take place tonight postponed due to a positive test. And we don't know if it was a player. We don't know if it was a coach. We don't know if it was stadium staff or whatever. But That is the reporting that we have. Uh-oh. So not great, right? I'm team bubble. Get these dudes into a bubble. Go, like, literally buy an island somewhere. Like get it done. Figure it out, right? That literally, I think, is the most realistic way.
Man, Hawaii's got that stadium for the Pro Bowl.
Literally, and you just like pay people's rent for the month, right? You get like, how many hotels do they have there? Like, how many guys can we get down there? You know what I'm saying? Like,
that's a bummer about the baseball news dropping, because we were talking before the show, and like, I was actually kind of talking, we were talking about the MLB, and I had thought, like, hey, outside of this Marlins thing, like, MLB actually has been running pretty well outside of this big gray cloud, big rain cloud that was the Marlins fiasco, because really just Juan Soto was the only player that had tested positive while the season had started. And I was like, you know, all these other teams are doing well outside of the Marlins and the team that had faced the Marlins that night. And then, so seeing another team pop up with a positive test is kind of, you know, definitely says it's a little bit kind of, because MLB, they're traveling more than the NFL is going to have to, and they're playing more games on a per day basis than the NFL is going to have to. And it's a bummer to see them not be able to kind of, you know, get this in order. And I thought, like, it was running better than people were giving it credit for a perception stance. But hearing that is definitely another, you know, real stab to the side.
Yeah, it's, you know, again, the NFL, they still, even though I feel as if they've kind of bungled it up to this point, they still have lots of time, right? They still have time to figure games out. They still have times to figure out if they need to redo the schedule. Like if you actually look at it this way, baseball went from guys on their couches to playing the very first game in 3 weeks. And we are 6 weeks away from the first scheduled regular season game, right? So there's time. The NFL can absolutely figure it out. But I think that the now common refrain, and I completely buy this, right? I am the target audience for this sales pitch, which is, because no position gains more value from the starter being injured ahead of them than running backs, this is the year to just be all in on the anti-fragility of the modified zero RB strategy.
It definitely does. It is sound if things go as bad as I think what some people are preparing for. I still think that there is an element of being pragmatic about the other side in play as well. But definitely if things are off the rails and guys are weekly testing positive and missing time, it's just math. I mean, a backup running back is going to come in and at least probably produce, 60 to 80% of what that lead back was doing, even if it's the guy isn't as good, if he gets the opportunity. I mean, listen, Reggie Bonifant is not going to be Christian McCaffrey, but if that guy's getting 50% of the team carries and 10% of the team targets, he's going to be a useful fantasy option. But the inverse isn't true. If Julio Jones was to miss time, like Russell Gage is going to be 80% of Julio Jones.
Yeah, Olamide Zaccheaus is not a wide receiver one if Julio Jones gets hurt.
Like, I mean, it would elevate a guy like Calvin Ridley, but like, it doesn't turn these nobodies waiver wire guys into something like it does at the running back position. Like, we talked about DeAndre Washington last year, us playing him over that stretch run. Like, it doesn't take a guy off the waivers and typically make him a fantasy starter at the wide receiver position like it would running back position. So, I mean, if things are going to be that bad, absolutely. I was prepared this season to come in just kind of full, robust running back, and then the Brooms were also on that plan too. So I kind of, pivoted and have kind of been just playing just where the value lies. I mean, I'll definitely take a guy I have as an RB1 if he falls. But, with running backs just going so high this year, highest draft capital ever. I had an article on it this week about running back ADP, and I was trying to pull it up, but I lost where I was at. Just kind of showing how high running backs are going in totality this year compared to where they were. And it's really hard to get in on that second wave of running backs because that's been the trap spot historically. I mean, that RB2 area, and they're going higher than ever. And now these RB2s are going over right receivers that are very projectable and safe. I mean, even if you don't like the position, I mean, we know the opportunities that are going to be available for DeAndre Hopkins, for Davante Adams, for Tyreek Hill. We know what the opportunity is, but
it's crazy, a lot
of fragility in some of these other guys, the Ecklers, the Drakes. Like, the upside is there. The definite one range of outcomes is good, but like the fragility is still like really there, where the fragility in those receivers is literally them being injured. Like, that's the fragility. And it's outside of last year too, running backs just ran so hot in the health department. RB1s only combined to miss 19 games last year, which is by far their lowest of the past decade. The previous seasons they had missed 56 games, 38 games, 33, 46, 39, 25, 29, and 36. They combined for just 19 missed games last year. It's pretty wild. You ran hot. Everyone stayed on the field. So inherently they were probably going to be more injury prone this year. And then if you tack on whatever this season needs, not even from a COVID perspective, the doctor guy, Edwin Porteous for Fantasy Points, had wrote about that in the 2011 season, which was a condensed offseason, that condition based injuries, hamstring, quad.
Yeah, dudes are gonna get banged up so much easier. Yeah.
And now that element is also in play this year with the abbreviated offseason, the conditioning based injuries, that we're gonna see early in the season and being a risk in that way as well. So I definitely do agree that there's a lot of upside, I think, more in, taking running backs and playing from that angle of like, hey, backup running backs are going to produce a certain higher caliber of threshold of points than backup receivers will. And those guys are from the waiver wires, aren't going to turn nothing into something at the waiver wide receiver position. So yeah, I mean, I'm kind of there too. I was kind of switching over to anchor modified running back. I don't know why people are so up in arms of a term. People are angry that it's called modified zero RB.
The smooth brains, bro. They always just want to argue.
Yeah, I mean, whatever you want to call it. But I had been shifting towards that anchor approach anyways and getting a lead running back, hammering wide receiver, and then coming back in the other tiers and getting my stable running backs. It's kind of where I had adjusted anyways. So, I mean, yeah, we'll see how it goes and what we actually see play out as far as the COVID stuff throughout the season. But I definitely think the condition-based injuries also on top of that adds a lot more reinforcement to, hey, let's get these wide receivers. They're really good. They're really good. They're just a lot better bets outside of the wide receiver or running back one position anyways. So you got a lot more safety there.
There's so much more safety, and it's just like – so when you kind of enter into one of these drafts, what basically happens is that you know, at some point, okay, if you don't get a top 6-7 pick, right? Because I'm taking Clyde Edwards-Helaire there now. I'm comfortable taking Miles Sanders. So if you can't get Miles Sanders, you can't get Clyde Edwards-Helaire. You have to decide, well, am I going to be that guy that takes Derrick Henry at 8 because I'm terrified, or Kenyon Drake because I'm terrified? Or do you take Mike Thomas? Do you take Travis Kelce, George Kittle, especially in the FFPC, which is tight end premium? And then, so let's say you do that, right? And you're committed. Well, then you're sitting there at your third pick and you're looking at Amari Cooper, Mike Evans, DJ Moore, Juju Smith-Schuster. And are you going, well, what, do I take James Conner? Do I take Chris Carson? Do I take Leonard Fournette? Do I take Melvin Gordon over those guys? And you're like, well, I don't really want to. And then that same conversation exists in the fourth round, because generally your league mates are still taking these running backs. Like, they're gobbling up David Montgomery at the beginning of the fourth round and leaving you Smith-Schuster, Odell Beckham, whoever. Where I find that I start to take the dip is when it gets to the Julian Edelman, Devontae Parker, Jarvis Landry guys, like fifth, sixth round. I'm like, okay, well, I can take Cam Akers here. I can take DeAndre Swift here. I can take David Montgomery here. I can take Kareem Hunt here. So kind of that, to me, that dead zone, that trap zone, that the road of his research and that Ben Gretsch backed up with his stuff at CBS last year. I'm cool taking running backs in the fifth and sixth, over as long as, once A.J. Brown goes off the board, to me, that's the flashpoint of, okay, I actually like the running backs about the same as the wide receivers here.
Yeah, I can get with that. Like I said, it's really just about avoiding that trap spot that you hit on. I mean, we've been historically so bad at, like, drafting RB 15 through 30. And then really, if you look at the bust rates and hit rates for guys that produce, you know, RB1 seasons, or guys that just really tank, they're relatively the same. Like, you know, from that next wave of running backs. So why not just go the cheaper route? The same is true at tight end. Like, that tight end too, that secondary tight end here, has historically just been a nightmare. We've been terrible at setting the market there. All those, like, the bust rate and the hit rate is lines up with the next wave of tight ends. So, like, why not just keep waiting? And the same thing happens at quarterback, like, 7 through 12 versus, like, the top QB2 tier. So it's like that. Those are, like, the trap spots. Like, don't get caught in those waves, even if there's a position run going on and at those price points. Just stay out of it. I mean, because we've been terrible at drafting those pockets of tiers at those positions. So just don't even get involved in them. Like, I mean, don't chase the one guy that's like Aaron Jones last year. Like, sure, you could be the guy at Aaron Jones, but yeah, you're probably.
Well, the problem was last year is that every guy was Aaron Jones last year, except for Devonta Freeman, right? Fournette got there. Gurley got there.
Fournette was higher. I mean, Fournette was just a smidge higher, right? Like, he was.
Yeah. But people did not get punished for taking second and third round running backs last year, other than Freeman, really.
Well, Melvin Gordon.
Gordon was pretty fine when he played, though, right? Now, obviously, you missed out on six games, but he was mostly fine while he played. What, he score like 8 touchdowns?
Yeah, I think that those guys worked out because of that. Him and Gurley especially, too, just because they found the end zone. Like, it worked out.
Yeah.
Yeah, I guess, yeah, it was, you know, Sony was in that group. Well, Mark Ingram worked out, too.
I mean, just last year was the year to be a high-T drafter, right? It was the year to go in and say, I'm pounding every, you know, dusty old – Le'Veon Bell, right? Le'Veon Bell, there was one. You got punished if you took Le'Veon Bell. He was terrible.
Yeah, it was rough for Le'Veon. Yeah, definitely there. But, I mean, you also just don't want to do what won last year. Like, it happens every year with fantasy football. Like, if you look at people's rankings and projections, what do? They resemble what just happened.
What just happened.
Yeah. What just happened. Like, ever.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it happens every year. People double down on a strategy that just happened, and, you know, tend to draft the players that worked out last year, especially, you know, some of the outliers. I mean, that's why Derrick Henry is up there. I mean, Derrick Henry is just such a fascinating player to me. I mean, because none of it makes sense. None of how the Titans operated makes sense. We talked about the betting show we used to do last year in the playoffs, everything. Just
like,
none of it made any sense.
How do you fade it? Yeah.
I mean, well, we talked about last year, too, under Tannehill. I mean, them in the red zone, they kicked one red zone field goal under Ryan Tannehill.
No, dude, it was they kicked wasn't it they only literally kicked one, they only made one field goal from the time Tannehill took over, like, period?
Yeah, from, well, in the red zone from Tannehill taking over, they were 26 of 30 in the red zone on converting red zone drives for touchdowns. Just 26 of 30 period, which is just mind-blowing. And then they had one field goal and three turnovers on the other drives. And they scored a touchdown on all those other possessions, which is just unreal. They didn't have a drop pass, a holding penalty on a third down, anything to, like, screw them. Like, it was just, they ran so pure. And Derrick Henry ran so pure. They were at the bottom of the league in plays run inside the five. It was just crazy. And inside the 10, it still scored all these touchdowns. It was bonkers. And then Derrick Henry doesn't catch passes. Like, there's just so much, like, where you're like, gosh, like, but then is he just such a unicorn?
He is a unicorn, right? He is a unicorn. I think, it's wild, but man. I mean, unless he is like Eric Dickerson and Bo Jackson and Gale Sayers all in one, it's going to be very hard for me to imagine the Titans offense performing anything like their 2019 selves in 2020. It feels unbelievable to me. Like, the guy I like is AJ Brown, because AJ Brown actually benefits the most from them regressing back to like a normal, like a league average touchdown conversion and everything, because his target volume goes through the roof in that scenario.
I'm fine with him where he goes. I mean, he's one of those guys I think that I thought coming in would probably be highly drafted than he was, you know, set in ADP, because, you know, now the regression mongers are actually take hold in the actual general public now than they did prior. I mean, a guy like AJ Brown maybe 5 or 6 years ago would be a locked in first round pick, and now
he's
wide receiver too. So I mean, just the fact that he's there kind of says something about how far fantasy football has come. So I mean, I think that he's fine at his cost. I think that there's some volatility there in the way he got his targets and the way he used his targets. They're definitely going to need to use him in a better fashion in year two, which I think definitely is possible. But he got so much of his yards just off that play action, clearing a linebacker that got sucked in on the Derrick Henry play action, and then just like yak after the catch. So, like, he was just like running deep digs and posts like behind the play action, getting all his yardage off of that. So they're going to need to use him a little better and give him more natural targets. I'd like to see him just get more natural targets. And we saw that happen in the postseason where Corey Davis actually out-targeted him. It's like they really struggled just getting him the ball naturally. Outside of these like shot plays, they were getting into the football, and there's definitely a lot of room for him to grow and get this. I'm not saying it's not possible, but I definitely would like to see that usage of AJ Brown grow, where he's just not running a deep dig off the play action and then turning that, you know, opportunity of space into a 35-yard gain. I would like to see him get just more 8-yard catches, just get like mix in a couple 8-yard catches, you know, for AJ Brown. Let him run a hitch.
Well, I mean, an eight-yard pass was actually a shallow average depth of target for Tannehill, right?
Right. He ran so hot in the mid range. Our guy Dan Pizzuta talked about like how just ultra hot he's run over, like compared to all quarterbacks the past decade on throws 10 yards to 19 yards downfield, and how that lined up for his career, just how big a difference is. And why is that? And I just hit on it. That's the play action zone, man. That's where you're running in. You're throwing it. That's the second level. And that's where they were just crushing. So, I mean, if they don't have that at their disposal, the game script doesn't, you know, fall into place. And actually, they were a team that had awful game script anyways, even with Tannehill. And they still – that's what, again, doesn't – nothing they did made sense last year. Because even under Tannehill, they only led for 27% of their snaps, which is just mind-blowing. And every other playoff team was at, you know, the average rate of playoff teams was 35%. The Titans actually led for the lowest rate of snaps of any team that made the playoffs last year. It was mind-blowing. Everything they did ran so pure. Everything just – they're a team that we could talk about for hours.
They may go down. They may go down in NFL history as like one of the most run pure teams of all time. I mean, basically I contend that if that Lamar to Mark Andrews pass on that first drive in the Baltimore Titans playoff game, so it's in Mark Andrews' hands, right? It's sitting there in his hands. It bounces off. It lands into a Titans hand for the first interception of the game. I contend that if that is either an incomplete pass or if Mark Andrews just hauls that in and Baltimore scores in the red zone, because that's what they always do, they win that game like 40-7. And this magical Titans run is over, basically.
I mean, there was a lot. They had 2 4th-and-1s they got stuck on to, which they had been the hottest team all year. Once that regression came all at once. They missed two of those. So everything kind of went wrong in that sense. The great thing about that game, which I think people lose sight of, though, is that so last year the Ravens, you know, they obviously they went 14-2. They led for the highest snaps in the NFL. They just operated in supreme game script all year. But we actually got to see Lamar Jackson in like a complete like shattered glass, like jailbreak scenario. And it was unreal. Like he on DK, he had both bonuses. He had 300 yards passing and 100 yards rushing. We saw him drop back at the highest, the most amount that he ever did in his career. Yep. And it was like, and you got to see like, all right, well, Lamar Jackson in a controlled setting was the league MVP. And yeah, granted, he ran hot in the touchdown department, which will definitely come down. But Baltimore also just never operated in these like, hey, we have to score points every possession for a whole half. Like they didn't all year. It was two games, the Browns game and the Chiefs game. And those happened in the first month of the season. Outside of that, it wasn't until that Titans game we saw that, and you really saw like what the fantasy ceiling for Lamar Jackson was if like he's just dropping back the whole game.
And if they're they're trying every every down, yeah, every series they're trying to score.
And it was bonkers. Now they're not going to have this year. Like they're not going to be in that. But if they just have a couple more games like that, like,
four more competitive games, man, or whatever.
Like, dude, because in the second half, they had to come out and try. They were like, we have to try to score every possession, and they had to play with some urgency. And you look at the amount of fantasy points Lamar put up in that game, and it was just insane, like what he could offer if they have to play in settings like that, in environments like that. It was even way worse, like, of a hammer than in season when they were just in a controlled environment. He was just running hot because of touchdowns. Like, man, it could be really scary if he gets in some more games like that where he's just dropping back 60 times a game, because that's just insane for his fantasy ceiling.
Yeah, I've been thinking about – so, like, I mean, clearly there's going to be some big-time regression in Lamar efficiency metrics, sure, right? He's going to throw some more interceptions. He's probably going to fumble a couple more times. He's going to take some more sacks. I would imagine his – like, when Lamar ends his career – how I am, you know, with MVPs and Super Bowl trophies and everything, my guess is his career adjusted yards per attempt is going to be like 8, probably, right? That includes his record-breaking rookie year. But that also obviously is going to mean there's going to be some painful seasons where he just is not quite as good, because he, in a way, Lamar does kind of play high-variance football. And the Ravens do in general, where, like, you know, they leave the opponents out by obviously running with their quarterback a ton. You know, quarterback injuries and fumbles are just like, quarterbacks fumble at a higher rate than running backs when they get tackled, and they go for it on fourth down all the time, which is a huge edge in game. But when you don't get it, the downside is pretty massive, especially when you're doing it from your own side of the field and everything. And then you have to throw a ton of passes. But basically, this is a long-winded way of saying, I expect Lamar's win-loss results to probably be a little bit worse this year. But that's actually, in a sick way, the only way he could have duplicated his fantasy success from last year was for them to play more competitive games. Because I don't think, like, it's very unlikely that they come out and they just blow out all these other teams and they're winning by 30 at half a bunch.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the good thing is like, you know, quarterbacks on designed runs don't actually get injured as much as they do in hits in the pocket.
Yes. Yes.
And, I think we had talked about it on a podcast last year when people were talking about quarterback injuries and how all the guys that were hurt were actually just, you know, like pocket passers, like all the guys that missed time. And it wasn't, I think the only guy that really, and Lamar's actually really good at not taking hits as well. The only guy that it kind of has the RG3 gene in him right now, I think, is Watson a little bit.
He gets stuck, dude.
Yeah, Watson, that sometimes he you're like, come on, man, like you can't, like, and he's like helicoptering, jumping over dudes, and like this, he has a little bit of the RG3 gene in him. Lamar actually is really good at not taking hits, and Lamar's really hard to tackle in the first place, but Watson has that in him a little bit where you're like, come on, man, like I can't have you taking that kind of hit, man, like, you don't need to do that. I think in week one, right out of the gates against the Saints, he had a touchdown run against the Saints where he jumped over
he flipped, landed.
And you're, yeah. Okay, man, it's week one, dude. Like, we can't, you gotta slow your roll, Sean. Can't have this. But he's that one of those guys that does the Russell Wilson thing where he'll try to concede yards in the pocket. Russell Wilson, I never seen a quarterback in my life that played in our days. Like, you go back to like Fran Tarkington, like the 70s stuff, that like completely turns his back to the defense and concedes yards to run
in a circle. Like, well,
and like
Mahomes does that. Well, this should go back to the man, the myth, the legend, Tony Romo. Romo would do
Romo too,
the spin move, right? Yeah, when you feel the pressure coming in on your shoulder and you spin back around to get out of it, and at a certain point, you know, you're sitting back staring at your own end zone while you're doing that, and things can get pretty wild. But yeah, I mean, yeah, that's
Russ
one of the
does it, man. Oh, like, yeah. So much, like more than a quarter. Like I said, like, you concede yards to gain yards. Like this dude's turning around and running 8 yards backwards with his back to the defense. He's not even looking at a receiver because he's running backwards. Deshaun does that too a little bit. That's why his sack counts are so high. I took Deshaun in SFB and was a little worried because he does take so many sacks in that format. But, I mean, he's another guy, when you look at his splits, like trailing, he's one of those outlier guys that, like, he's way better when they play from behind because Bill O'Brien can't get in the way of him. And we saw that.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure when they get behind, Watson's like, okay, guys, I'm calling the plays, right? Like, just understand that we're not listening to what Bill O'Brien is telling us when we're down 10 points. It's all
me. Even against the Bills in that playoff game, which was a really good defense last season, when they fell behind, you know, seven, I think it was 17-0 at half. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe it was 13-0. They were down at the half, and he came in and played better football in the second half. He's just one of those guys that has – played, and all his rate stats go up trailing, which is uncommon for quarterbacks. And then this year, I expect them kind of projecting them to be worse, and they have a harder schedule too. Like, so, like, I expect them to be like some weird things where Deshaun's probably not as good as a quarterback he's been in years past, but like has an out to be a better fantasy quarterback still, even though his fantasy bar is still really high. That's why I haven't faded him as much as I thought I would, like just coming in context of him losing Hopkins, having all these new playmakers, because I think they're going to have way worse game script this year. And the core is still decent, is good enough in context of being, you know, good amongst the league if these guys can stay healthy. But I think that they're going to play a lot more jailbreak scenario too, the Texans. And he really hasn't been in those spots the last few years.
That, I mean, just this is a good reminder to everyone that we got two of maybe the best 10 plays in this decade of NFL history in that Bills Texans playoff game. So we got the Josh Allen lateral to Dawson Knox when he was like getting crunched in between two defensive linemen. And I don't know if I have ever stood up and like gasped at my TV the way I did when Watson shook off the two defensive ends, spun out of it, and then completed that pass to Tywan Jones. I mean, that was like Mahomes, like even better. Like, I don't even think Mahomes can make that play. Deshaun Watson might be the only guy alive who can shake off those sacks and complete that pass. It was so phenomenal.
Also the Josh Allen fullback nine route.
Yep, you're right. That also was amazing.
The 60-yard. That has to be the most air yards a fullback's ever had on one target in maybe NFL history.
Maybe the deepest pass that's ever been thrown to a fullback in the playoffs also seems possible.
He could get a couple deep targets where he gets lost in defense, but that was like a legit like 50-yard like YOLO ball to a fullback.
You can't stop Josh Allen. You can only hope to contain him.
What a gift Josh Allen is. Like, absolute gift he is.
If he wins the MVP, Silva's never gonna stop beating his chest about it. And he shouldn't. If you pound the drum that hard on someone who's gonna win MVP at 50-1 and they get there, you should make it your Twitter display name. Like, Josh Allen 2020, no one knew but me. # Evan Silva.
I mean, the logic is pretty sound for his reasoning. I mean, it's the same reason for Lamar. Like
Lamar,
last
year. Yeah.
I mean, you've got if the team's gonna be good win loss wise, and he's, you know, projecting the Bills to be a team that is that, and the quarterback play usually goes along with win losses, and if he plays well, that's probably, you know, they're probably why they won games. So, and he's got the rushing upside. So, I mean, if he has a 40 touchdown combined season in him. Yeah, I mean, that's the play. And we've seen it happen with Lamar last year. The quarterback's going to win MVP. That's what we know. So, I mean, why even bet on any other player?
Right. Okay, the last thing I want to cover here is I want to get some Mecole Hardman talk with someone who I think does not agree with me. Because I think you are mostly out on Mecole Hardman at his ADP. And it depends on the league where you're drafting him in. Like, this Hardman's one of those guys where his ADP says he goes in like the 10th round, right? Like wide receiver.
It's 40. Very league to league variant.
Yes. There's always someone, it seems to me, and a lot of the times I'm this guy that's just like, whatever, I'm taking Mecole Hardman in the 8th round if I feel the need to do that. And I actually think it's fine, right? And the reasons for that are, there's a lot of reasons for it. The first one being, The opportunity cost after you pass like the sixth, seventh round just really gets it's just very low because all these guys project really flat. In weekly management leagues, you're very oftentimes going to be cutting these guys, and you should really be focusing on guys who, if and when they hit, they become parts of mega teams, right? Just like guys who are going to average 15, 16 fantasy points per game. And I actually think the path to Mecole Hardman doing that is way more clear than a lot of other people seem to think. First of all, I think he can do it without a Sammy Watkins injury. I think he can just straight up outplay him, right? And be ahead of him. Also, I talked about this with Warren Sharp on the TakeCast earlier this week. The Chiefs actually went kind of the direction of a lot of other teams in the league of playing a lot more 12. So playing Blake Bell, playing Anthony Sherman, playing Deion Yelder, those guys in there. And it would not surprise me with Blake Bell leaving for them to just play a bunch of 10, right? To just go empty, Clyde Edwards-Helaire, four wide receivers. So that's my bully pulpit. Give me your Mecole Hardman take.
I'm actually, you know, on both sides of this. I mean, I definitely – so I have another game theory thing I'll get to in a second, but just Mecole Hardman in general. So Hardman last year, you know, obviously we know he played the 13 games, you know, including the postseason, in games where Watkins and Hill played, and he totaled 18 targets in those games total. And two of those games, Tyreek Hill played 12 snaps and one he played seven. They bring everyone back. They bring everyone back.
Everyone except for Bell, yeah.
So someone's – so in order for Mecole Hardman to make a target jump, someone's targets have to come way down. Obviously, the shortest straw is to say Sammy Watkins. But they're also – their running back targets can also spike now this year too with Clyde Edwards-Helaire. He could actually –
I think it will.
So, I mean, we have to pull targets away from someone, and Watkins probably – isn't going to be a guy who gives up a ton of targets because he didn't have a ton of targets to begin with. So it's really hard to find that jump. Now, Hardman in general is a guy, so from a redraft stance in a seasonal league, I haven't been drafting for two reasons. One is I believe he's like one of those guys we talked about earlier. His best moments are going to come where I don't play him. And the second reason is I'm never going to want to cut him because the upside he could present if there's an injury to
Watkins. Yeah, the roster clogger scenario.
So then he becomes the scenario where he's a paperweight on my roster because I'm not playing him and I'm not cutting him, which is why I don't draft these handcuffs, which are terrible bets anyways. You know, the Tony Pollards of the world that just have no standalone value on their own. You're just waiting for injury because you're never going to cut that guy. He's just going to sit there. But I've been drafting a ton of Mecole Hardman in these best ball leagues where I don't have to get the week right of playing him and then he has the upside. So, other reason I've been drafting in season long leagues too, is because we talked about the flip, the oscillation of drafting wide receivers and running backs. And by the time Hardman typically comes up in these seasonal leagues, I have shifted back towards
wide receivers,
the Zach Mosses and the dudes like that go in the area. So I'm pretty loaded at wide receiver, and I'm trying to get these running backs that I believe have some, you know, upside and some standalone value in them. So I'm back to taking running backs. But I have also deployed guys that I find undervalued. I call them the wide receiver twos of the world. I don't know. I haven't found a good like verbiage for it because it's not wide receiver handcuffs, but not a lot of people cook the upside of players missing time, the wide receiver one missing time, into wide receiver two and wide receiver three cost. But if you look at it, we talk about like Russell Gage isn't a guy that's going to – he'll come in and get more targets but won't produce if on Julio Jones level. But what it does mean is that Calvin Ridley now becomes a wide receiver one, you know, with Julio Jones out. And a lot of people cook that into these guys that go into that tier of wide receivers. I mean, if Tyler Lockett misses 4 weeks, DK Metcalf is going to have like a border on like 25 to 30% market share. And it's not cooked into his cost. So that's why I like taking a lot of these high wide receiver twos, because they become wide receiver ones in a season and elevate. Hardman is kind of on the fringe where he's probably a wide receiver three that becomes wide receiver two. But in that area of guys where wide receiver twos goes, like the Cooper Cups, the Robert Woods, these guys that have teammates going in that same pocket, I feel like that a lot of people are undervalue a lot of guys in that climate, because a lot of people think that they're just equal. But these are guys that become wide receiver ones in a fantasy sense. They don't just become useful. They become guys that get those market shares that we want, the 25%. Even a guy like Mike Williams is like this. You know, is if Keenan Allen was to miss time, they have no depth. on that roster at the wide receiver position. When Keenan Allen missed time, he didn't miss any games last year, but the year before, Mike Williams came out and had the most targets he ever had.
Just smashed.
And when, it was against the Chiefs on that Thursday night game and just crushed. Like that. So even he's a guy I believe is undervalued from a target sense. And then when you factor in the types of targets that Mike Williams gets, if he's ever to ever have a value increase, like if Mike Williams ever was a guy that ran to 110 targets, like he's a guy you want to be in on. All his targets come in the end zone and downfield. Those are like all the fantasy targets we care about. So, I mean, if he was the only reason people don't like him is because he gets 85 targets instead of 110 targets. But like he would run into a Kenny Galladay-like season if he was to get 110 targets, like pretty easily. Even with a guy like Tyrod Taylor or even Herbert, if you were to just say, I'm going to get 110 targets, I would draft him every draft. And I do draft him a lot, but not a lot of people factor in that.
Mike Williams is one of those guys where when someone takes him, you're like, you're probably good at fantasy football. Like there are some players that are, I've noticed this, that are like people who are really good at fantasy football tend to draft these guys. And then people who maybe I just don't agree with their like holistic approach to the activity tend to take other styles of players. And over the years, I've noticed that like people who are really good tend to load up on Mike Williams because of what you're saying, right? 110 targets, he turns into a smash basically because he's got all the things you want from a secondary wide receiver. Like his production's going to be really focused on touchdowns, which actually we want from wide receivers. Like when they get there, we want 30 point weeks, not 18 point weeks.
Yes.
Yeah. And
I wrote that article last week about where I broke down like everyone's career targets, where they come from. And Mike Williams he's first in deep ball rate. 38% of his targets come on throws 15 yards or further downfield. I took the top 40 receivers in ADP. He's number one in deep ball rate. He's number one in red zone rate. He's number three in end zone target rate. So you're getting the types of targets that you want. The overall volume is what depresses his ADP. So, those are the money targets. Those are what you want.
Yeah, I mean, exactly. And you want them deep down the field, right? And so Williams does both. Yeah, Williams is going to both get touchdowns, both be targeted down the field, and he has some standalone value. Like there are going to be some weeks where he goes for four targets, 85 yards and a touchdown. And like you can start him. And by the way, I think the same thing is true for Hardman too, by the way, which is why I don't view him as much of a roster clogger as other people, because me personally in leagues where you start two running backs, two wide receivers, two flex there, it's going to be fine. Like I am not going to be like, man, I can't start Mecole Hardman. Like, again, week seven, bye weeks, injuries, whatever, I'm going to be fine tossing Mecole Hardman in there versus someone like Jamison Crowder, who, yeah, I mean, maybe Jamison Crowder is going to have 3 10-target games this year for the Jets, but I would rather, like, Mecole Hardman literally only needs one target to get there, right? Like, well, that's something we know about him. He can literally get there on one target, so I'm cool starting him during that, you know, that bye week roulette.
Yeah, so the other guys like in that area that would just talk about that like fall under this game theory element for me are taking these guys that are, you know, reasonable guys that have standalone value as wide receiver twos and threes in their offense alone, but also have, you know, more just uncooked upside. I mean, Jarvis Landry is in that mold. Michael Gallup, even CeeDee Lamb, a step down. Either of the Texans guys, both fit that. These are guys that are cheap that you don't draft as your wide receiver one or two on your roster. They're your wide receiver three and your flex guys, but have that upside if Odell misses time, if Amari Cooper misses time, if Brandon Cooks or Will Fuller misses time. Like those are guys that, you know, Marvin Jones is in that group too, where their target share does become that 25% up range on a game basis instead of the 20% that we are drafting them at right now. The DK is like those, like that's where you strike, man. Those are the upside plays. And then you factor in if some of those guys are getting the types of targets we want, like a DK does, or Mike Williams, like that's where you really, really can run into a season where you're just destroying value where you had, because you're getting a guy that's not only, like you said, turning in these like 15 point games. He's giving you 25s and 30s, which is what we want. Absolutely. So, I mean, yeah, I definitely want to shoot for that upside. Now, I see a lot of people, too, like throw the Mike Evans shade back to you. It's, well, 35% of his points came in three games. You want that. You want those guys to win you weeks. Because, one, there was a study done on this, I believe it was not done on football guys, where the average fantasy matchup isn't even close to begin with. like the actual, like the discrepancy of points. Like, me beating you by 4 points really does, like if those games are rarer than like most games aren't decided. It's like having a guy that gets you like 12 points or whatever, has a guy that gets you 25 points and gets 8 the next week, his 8s aren't losing you as many games as you think they are.
As you think. Oh, like, such a good point, dude. Yes, like that's such a good point.
But someone did a study on this where, like, the average fantasy game – I think it's Football Guys. I might be wrong. But, like, where the average fantasy matchup is not close to begin with. Like, it's – so you want ceiling weeks. You want guys that are going to smash someone into oblivion because the low points aren't losing you the amount of weeks that you believe they are, even though your mind definitely – because what is the rule? Like, when you losing a dollar is way worse than winning $2. Like, that's – you know, like, people say, like, oh, Mike Evans got me 8. Damn it, I can't – Chase's 40-point game, like because like that's how it is. That's how our minds work. But you know, his 8s really aren't losing you weeks like you think they are.
Yeah, I mean that is, that kind of sums up my fantasy football philosophy, right? Which is like people who are focusing on making sure they get a bunch of guys who never get fewer than 8 fantasy points. Like that's just the inverse of how I approach the activity. I want dudes who are gonna bink me 30 points twice a year. Like that tends to be something, especially in which I don't ever like, it's hard to tell how many people who listen to this and who read my stuff are like grinding like the stuff I'm grinding, or if like they're just playing their 12 team home league. Like as the years have gone on, I care way more because I did so many of these last year. Like I care way more about my main event teams, my Football Guys players championship team. Not that I have given up trying to win my 12-team home league with my buddies from high school that I've literally never won and that they give me an endless amount of shit about for having never won. But, yeah, I mean, in those leagues, like, I could give a shit less about getting Jarvis Landry or whatever. Like give me the dudes who are going to bink for me.
Yeah, and I don't want to say, like, just, like, I'm only targeting those guys and, like, I'm going to have a whole roster as those guys. Like, definitely I'm into Robert Woods. I think Robert Woods is cool. I think Landry's cool. Like,
Robert Woods has more ceiling than you're giving him credit for, putting him in that category. Like, if that guy has a 10-touchdown season, bro, it's over. He's going to be wide receiver 4.
Well, that's what it's contingent on, is him scoring touchdowns.
Yeah, which he's never done.
Yeah, and doesn't get the opportunity to score touchdowns because he's one of those guys in that article I talk about. But I mean, I'm absolutely like those guys. It's not to say that those guys don't serve a purpose either. Like you want guys that still get 140 targets. Like that still matters.
Yes.
It's just that those
especially
guys
when you can get them cheaply.
It's just that those guys are more contingent on their high volume holding water than it is the inverse fashion of the guys we talked about. But I mean, I like a lot of those guys that still get 140 targets. Don't get me wrong. I mean, I'm smashing Thielen. Like, I mean, Thielen is insane. Like, have you been doing how many main event and Football Guy championship teams?
I've done 2 Football Guys. I've been pounding out the Drafters Best Ball Championships, and then my Pros versus Joes. So, I love Thielen in. I would like him to be a cornerstone of the main event, especially if we are because you and I
falls in those in the FFPC format. He goes in the 4th every draft.
Yeah, you and I, me, you, Evan, and Thorman are. I think we're doing one on August 13th, maybe. I'm not. I don't remember the date. But yeah, I
think we're in a main event.
Oh, beautiful, almost, beautiful. Yeah. So that's gonna be great. And yeah, Thielen would be a dude that I would be. Thielen would be a dude that I would be. Because cool
is he
with,
one
sure.
of those guys? Do you have trouble with? Because like he's a guy in like my projections. Always like I'm always like
man, he's like wide receiver 8 in my projections.
I'm like, how high do I have to move this dude? Like how like or do you want to like? I mean, he
no. It's the other. It's the other way for me. I don't want him to be this high. I'm like, I want to get. Get me Adam Thielen out. When I did my first run of projections, as training camps were getting ready to start, I redid everything, like all my baselines. I checked everyone's target shares, and I hit export. You know, and I went to go look at them all in the cheat sheet. He was wide receiver 4. For me with doing no like check for sanity work or anything. And then I went back in and I was like, okay, well I'm gonna move this around. But like that was just like my first intuition was basically making him like a second round pick.
I mean, I just go into every draft because of where he goes in drafts and like some of the guys he goes ahead of and or some of the guys that go ahead of him. And I'm just so happy every time, every draft, especially in the FFPC formats, running backs, like you said, are getting hammered. Like James Conner is going at like the 2-3 turn in these drafts now. And, you know, Thielen's going in the fourth round. And I'm just so ecstatic every draft.
Yeah. I mean, I like James Conner. I don't like him at the 2-3 turn. I like him at the 3-4 turn. Yeah.
Same.
So, you know, I guess if we are pounding, you know, wide receivers, then if the room pounds running backs, you gotta zig, right? You gotta zig when everyone else is zagging. That's what you gotta do.
It's tough, like I said. You don't want to get in on that secondary wave, man. But now that Clyde Edwards-Helaire jumped, I mean, he adds another bullet to the guys that you feel confident of going with that anchor running back approach. I think he's just another guy you feel good about having as like your linchpin, because he's game script proof and he's attached to a great offense. So he makes that, I think he reinforces it, makes it even a better strategy to go that route.
Yeah. All right, man. I think we just got like an hour and a half in. You love to see it. Always a pleasure chatting with you. No, man, it's the best. I very much enjoy doing shows with you. Tell people about the sick tiers project that you guys have going on over at Sharp Football right now.
So I put out a tiers PDF, which is kind of like, if, you know, people always ask me when I left Roto World, you know, would I still do the tiers? I used to do for the Roto World Draft Mag, if you ever picked that up. I used to do all the tiers write-ups for that magazine. So I basically took that concept and since I have no limitations, because it's just a PDF and it's, I don't have a word count, just wrote up these guys. Ended up being 66 pages, full write-ups and like players and tiers. And tiers, like I hit upon on the show, is how I draft the most off. I care about arbitrage in draft. I care about how guys get their points from a fantasy stance and how I can get a player that does the same thing later. The only reason he's priced down is because opportunity is great. We know opportunity is inherently fragile anyways. And so how can I get some of these guys? So you can go in there, get in that tiers file, see guys that are grouped together and say, oh yeah, I can get this guy 4 rounds later. You know, definitely some value here. And I can tack my draft on that. So that's available to our subscribers. We've got all the rankers. We're starting to switch. I did a bunch of free content this offseason. We're starting to switch over to do like an online draft guide over this last month, where I'm trying to hit people hard and like how to draft and how I'm drafting this year and sharing how I'm drafting. So definitely go check that out. Sharpfootballanalysis.com. If you are on the fence to see like, hey, I don't know if I want to do a subscription, I've got over 100 free articles as well that have been done this off season. So you can check that out. I've been working hard for you to see if like maybe it's the type of content you would like to see. And then the most popular article I've had recently is that target article, where the types of targets, you know, players have gotten over their careers in 2019 for context, to see, like, we talk about the Mike Williams and the Robert Woods, and you can see the really fantasy fat and fantasy rich targets, where these guys are getting their targets and who isn't. So definitely go check out those articles. We're good. Listen, the season's gonna start. They're gonna do this. Old money isn't acquiesce. Old money is gonna fight.
Old money don't quit. You try telling what's the dipshit owner of the Houston Texans name? I don't, like, you try telling that guy that they're not playing this season. Yeah, right, bro. They're gonna bring in Bo Levi Mitchell and a bunch of these guys who are playing in the CFL, because this is actually overlooked. No CFL season, and the fact that we have all these names of guys who played in the XFL and the AAF, there is more like street free agent quality players who are ready to play than ever before. Like they're going to make it happen, even if they have to play.
Well, what happened to the floating idea that the XFL had? The NFL had some talks about it in the summer, and then did that just get shelved, where they were going to have like the floating roster and dudes can pull guys off of that at any time?
Right. Yeah. I have no idea.
I haven't heard anything since then about it. But because that was actually a great thing for the XFL. Like, that was a really good like.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Team. I mean, I assume that because the season, like, you know, the XFL folded, that any sort of business agreement that the two organizations have also went awry. Right. So, but they are. You're 100% correct. They're making it happen. They are going to make it happen.
It's gonna start. I am confident it's gonna start.
It is gonna start.
I don't know what it's gonna look like, but it's gonna start.
Yeah, I mean, so we had that like maybe fake Nick Foles report the other day. Remember that?
Oh, yeah.
So when Adam Schefter reports that the first quarterback has opted out, I was talking with Greg Sussman the other day about this. it's going to be Kirk Cousins, right? Kirk has got that bag. The money's going to be waiting for him next year. Rodgers, dude. Oh, just a total FU to the Packers front office for not getting him a wide receiver.
Well, just in context of everything, like you saw that probably that interview that floated around, the interview with Kyle Brandt, where he totally believes he's not their future. So like, why not just like protect yourself in this year? Because who knows? Like, we don't know the ramifications. Like, what if you have like heart disease that stays or lung disease? We don't know. I'm not a doctor either, so I want to insinuate that that's real too. But like, if Rodgers believes this is his last year at the Packers, why not just sit out for then next year, force them to, you know, make the move, and then you're healthy. You got your money already. You're fine. And then you just go play for the team that wants you the next year, which will probably be John Elway and the Broncos. Because if any team's trading for him, it's probably Elway, right? Like, it's going to want him. So,
I mean, what if Drew Locke?
To me, he checks a lot of boxes where he'd just be like, yeah, I don't need this. I don't need this right now.
I was definitely thinking Cousins, but now that you say Rodgers, I'm like, no. Because it would be so funny.
About the player opt-out thing is like, there's going to be a window. Well, obviously, August 3rd, I believe, is the last day, but
it keeps getting pushed back, though.
But a lot of these guys have already reported. I think if you're reporting, like, you're probably going to go. So, I mean, I think that we're not going to see, like, as long as you see a quarterback reporting, like, he's probably not opting out. So, I mean, maybe some guys get in the building and they say, nah, this isn't going like I thought it was going to go. I'm going to pull out. But I think we're pretty much past the big wave. Maybe we have a name or two that pops, but a lot of these guys have already shown up, which kind of indicates like, hey, it's gonna happen.
Yeah, all right, sounds good, man. Thank you for coming on the show. We got it, because you and I, we could keep talking for literally ever, so I gotta end it. Let's hope Aaron Rodgers opts out and that the Packers fans absolutely blow a gasket. We'll be back soon, everyone. Thank you very much for listening.